Hello, and welcome to ESG Matters at Ashurst. I'm Elena Lambros, the Ashurst Risk Advisory Climate Change and Sustainability Partner. Welcome to the latest episode of Game Changers and Transition Makers. In this series, I'll be speaking to entrepreneurs around the globe who are at the forefront of driving the sustainability agenda through innovative business ideas and company startups. In this episode, I'll be joined by Chris Penser. Chris is the founder and creative director of Penser Events, a boutique corporate events consultancy based in London. Chris's creative approach always delivers something special for his progressive corporate clients who want a unique way to engage their most valued clients. Chris began his career in the art world, and he's now one of the UK's leading street art experts and street art historians. Chris is also a former competitive figure skater, which led him to create Street Art on Skates in lockdown, the world's first and only live stream street art tour on rollerblades, an experience he still hosts for clients all over the world. So, without further ado, let's jump in and hear the discussion. Thanks, Chris, for joining us today. We're so happy to have you on the podcast. So welcome.
Thanks for having me.
So I thought it would be really good. I think it's always nice for our listeners to understand. Could you just tell us a little bit about yourself, you know, and what your business is?
Sure. So I started my career as a British art expert and auctioneer at Sotheby's in London. And I'd come from a degree in art history where I studied at the Courtauld Institute. And my time at Sotheby's was, you know, a really wonderful part of my early career. And amongst many highlights of that time, I became the first person, kind of accidentally, but anyway, nonetheless, I became the first person to catalogue an artwork by the then unknown artist called Banksy for sale at auction back in 2005, which was a really interesting and amazing moment for me personally. It sort of marked, I guess, the moment that my interest in street art and graffiti was kind of peaked, but it also marked the transition of graffiti from street to gallery, which was a really seminal moment, I think. And in that early 2000s, the urban art movement, as it were, kind of really came up. And I was very lucky to sort of have a ringside seat. And I spent 7 or 8 very happy years at Sotheby's. But in 2010, I left Sotheby's to set up my own business, which I'd always, at the back of my mind, sort of dreamed about doing. Initially, I set up a behind-the-scenes arts club for young collectors and art lovers, where I would sort of leverage my contacts and unique access to the art world to create little pop-up events for collectors that would be 4 a month, and they would pay a subscription fee and they would have access to all these kind of really special events. But that very quickly became a boutique corporate events consultancy, because many of my members and collectors were, you know, young lawyers working in London, for example. And we started to do, you know, quite organically started to do private events for them and their clients. And so the business sort of naturally morphed into a boutique events consultancy, which was targeted exclusively at sort of corporates and their clients. So that's where I am today. Aside from that, I still, I suppose, keep my hand in with my graffiti and street art roots, because some of the sort of events that we do, particularly in the summer, focus around street art, because I do have I'm not your average street art tour guide. I have a kind of a very unique angle and sort of connection to that world. So I do connoisseurs walks, I do workshops and all sorts of things like that in the summer. So I still very much do that. And increasingly, the themes of ESG and sustainability and the environment actually kind of come into my world quite heavily, largely because that's what my clients are interested in, or certainly kind of exploring that. So there are lots of interesting kind of avenues that my work takes me in.
Yeah, that's absolutely fascinating. And so when we start kind of thinking about, you know, your clients now and the need that you're trying to solve, and you started touching on ESG, it'd be helpful to maybe just outline some of the events that you run and just how that works and how people kind of start to kind of engage with them.
Absolutely. So, I mean, if we just look at ESG, for example, you know, I'll be working on briefs with clients that might take me to creating panel discussion, for example, with some leading voices in the climate conversation. And we'll do that, you know, perhaps with some of the clients who kind of might be on the panel too, for an audience of their own clients. And it'll be in a really amazing space in London that has a huge screen so that we can kind of, you know, show some really inspiring images and videos and stuff as part of the conversation. It might also be, you know, for example, there's an amazing rewilding project. I don't know how many of your listeners are actually familiar with the UK, but in Sussex, which is about an hour and a half south of London, there is a 3,500-acre estate run by an amazing couple, Charlie Burrell and Isabella Tree. Isabella is a writer and, a climate activist of sorts. And they inherited this 3,500-acre estate, which had been farmed for many hundreds of years by their family. And in about 20 years ago, they decided to just let the entire estate go back to nature and not farm it. And people thought they were crazy at the time. And fast forward 20 years, and they have the most amazingly diverse ecology there. They have species of butterflies and, you know, free roaming herbivores that have not been on that land for hundreds of years. So it's a really amazing thing. And we do rewilding safaris there. We take a walk with Isabella and have a lunch with her, and she does a book signing. And the whole point of that exercise is to get people out of London, out of their sort of London bubble, London mindset, or any inner city mindset, take them into nature, and to have those conversations about how we can make an impact on, you know, the environment, either personally or with our clients or with the work that we do, actually in a space that is relevant to that conversation. So it's interesting that a lot of those kind of conversations, I guess, particularly at maybe governmental level, for example, will happen in a meeting room. And my view is, like, how can you really, for example, learn to love something that you can't see? So, you know, when I think about how I approach life with my children, for example, you know, if you don't take young people who, let's face it, you know, are the future, if you don't take those people into nature, how can you expect them to protect something that they don't learn to love, right? So I'm interested in that, not just with my children, but with my clients too. So we do all sorts of things like that. But, you know, the ESG point comes up even, believe it or not, in my street art adventures. So there's a mural in Southampton, which is, again, a quite a large city south of London, where there's a relatively new mural that has been painted with CO2 absorbing paint.
Oh, really? Sorry, I'm embarrassing that I didn't, but I haven't heard of that.
No, I mean, it's a relatively new concept, but I mean, innovation is happening wherever you choose to find it, right? So there's a workspace in Southampton called Bulb, or The Bulb, and, you know, an amazing street artist called Neurone has used a CO2 absorbing lime-based paint that naturally absorbs CO2 as it cures. And yeah, I mean, it's slightly difficult to sort of pinpoint exactly how much CO2, but they estimate that 145 pounds of CO2 is absorbed annually, which is about the equivalent of 3 mature trees. So considering that that's just a way that you paint the outside of a building, but actually could potentially have a really interesting impact on the climate, even if it's albeit in that little area. If you did that, you know, if that paint was, and I'm not advocating for this paint, I'm not a shareholder in this company, but if you painted all buildings with paint that could actually do something good for the environment, and obviously we can probably get into all sorts of conversations about even the production of paint is perhaps not environmentally friendly. There are a whole load of pitfalls we can fall into. But as a principle, you know, there are things that we can do as businesses and as individuals in our daily lives that can actually make quite a big impact. And I think I suppose that's interesting for me, because if you just read the papers or scroll through Twitter or pay attention to what's going on in the world, whether it's the environment or the politics or the economy or whatever it is, the world can feel like quite an overwhelming, intimidating place. And it's reasonable to think as an individual, like, what on earth can I do? Like, what can I, sitting here in my house in London, do to solve these like huge global problems? And the truth is, as an individual, you probably can't do much if you're just trying to solve those problems. But what you can do is, if you can look around your life and make little changes in whatever way you can, that's how you can create real change. And if everyone did that, then obviously we have a huge amount of power. And these sorts of things are the sorts of things that I've talked about with, you know, our panelists on climate panels, for example, you know, lots and lots of times. So I think there is a way that we can make change happen, but often it's about looking closer to home than perhaps, you know, at what governments are doing, you know.
Yeah, I actually love both of those examples. I love the rewilding example, and I love what they're doing there and taking people there to really feel it.
and, you know, see what you're protecting. And also even the example of paint, you're right, there's so much innovation, there are so many things you can do, and they're only little, but each one adds up in their own way, right? And I think that's what, you know, with your company, if I think about what you're trying to achieve and what you're talking about, it's really about kind of, you know, that power of art, you know, to kind of create that sense of community and social inclusion, which is actually really important around developing ESG and delivering on kind of some of those commitments, because it really kind of starts at that community level and making people feel like they're part of the change in some way.
I think that's exactly right. And I mean, my business is a people-based business, right? So I'm interested in people. I'm interested in human behavior. That's why, you know, my role to my clients is to help them make the very most of their own client relationships by creating opportunities to get together with their clients in a way that is not just spending money in a restaurant, or, you know, there is a place for those things. Of course, like, you know, sometimes you have a relationship with a client where you just have a coffee with them every few weeks and that works. But when you're kind of spending, you know, allocated business development budget, for example, to put on events that you invite your clients to, you know, my role really is to sort of try and push my clients to think, well, why don't we do something different? Why don't we, you know, why don't we surprise them? Why don't we kind of try and inspire them? Why don't we try and challenge them? Why don't we try and maybe provoke them a little bit? Not because we're trying to be provocative, but for the sake of it, but because actually when you make yourself vulnerable, which is, again, a whole nother topic we could discuss about, you know, to what extent you can be vulnerable with a client, because obviously your persona as a, I guess, particularly as a lawyer, or for me as an events consultant, you know, you want to be on a call with your client and then feeling like you have this, or you like, you know, all the answers. Yeah. And actually to be able to say like, I don't know the answer, but I'm really willing to try and find out, and let's go along together and do this thing together. And maybe it'll throw up some challenges or some interesting questions that we can discuss together. And actually at the end of all that, the aim would be that you know each other much better, which is the number one goal. And I think that's what our clients would say feedback wise is that, you know, we don't do run-of-the-mill events, we do interesting special events. That doesn't necessarily mean you need to have, you know, extraordinary budgets to do something special. You just need to approach it with an authenticity, and with a creative mind, because whilst my background was very much in the art world, I think what I try and do is apply creativity to the business world, which often feels like, whether it's true or not, lacks that sort of sense of creativity. You know, when I, for example, if I'm doing a street art workshop where, you know, we have two or three of the UK's probably most famous artists painting a mural with me and my clients, you know, one of the first things they always say is like, we're lawyers, we're not creative. And I always disagree with them. Say like, you know, creativity is a fundamental human attribute, like singing. Like people say, oh, I can't sing. It's like, can you make a sound with your voice? It might not be appealing to everyone, but you can sing. And I feel the same with, you know, graffiti and creativity. It's like encouraging my lawyer clients to understand that even if they don't see it this way, if they weren't creative, they wouldn't be good at their jobs. And they are fantastic at their jobs. So they must be able to kind of problem solve, be creative. And when they then get to the end of the workshop and they see what they've created together, they're always surprised. And I'm not surprised, but they always are, because, you know, they just didn't feel like that was in the toolkit, but it very much was.
Yeah, no, it's a really good perspective to bring to some clients and to some, you know, lawyers who are probably in some pretty high pressure jobs. So I'm looking at creativity and thinking about what else you can do and what are you doing on a day-to-day basis is probably pretty inspiring and important for them. So then if in terms of like what you were doing with your clients and with their clients, what would success look like to you?
That's interesting, because I think for me, in answering these questions, because I'm a self-employed consultant, it's very difficult to separate professional goals, I think, for me anyway, with my personal goals and my personal life, because my work is so much part of my daily life. I, you know, I work from home, as many millions of people now around the world do. So on a professional level, you know, I'm really trying to continue building a business that has a unique reputation in my field, and that is, you know, business development and strategic client relationship management. So I often get called, you know, my client's best kept secret, you know, which might sound like I have an issue with marketing, but I like it that way. You know, I like to be someone who my clients feel I'm at the end of a phone or an email, and whenever they call me or email me, they're going to get some kind of creative response that will solve the problem that they're looking to solve. And I really love that. So I have excellent relationships with my clients. Obviously, like any business, I'm always looking to widen my client base, of course, but I really want to do that sustainably because, you know, my business development goal, I suppose, is to do as much work as I can physically cope with without having to employ a business partner or anyone else, because actually I really enjoy being a kind of, I guess, a lone wolf in that sense. Whenever I work on an event, I'm always working as part of a team, but they're a team that I assemble on a sort of project basis, if you like. But I really like being my own boss and not having to manage anything other than my life and my time. So all of those things are kind of, you know, I really want to continue doing work that excites me and excites my clients and, you know, pushes me and pushes them and is creative, et cetera, et cetera. But I think also success in business alone wouldn't, for me personally, be success. Like, I have three kids and I'm really committed to being a present, active parent. You know, I didn't, you know, in terms of if I think about like my father, for example, you know, he wasn't present. And without sort of turning this into a kind of family therapy session, you know, I'm trying to balance the things that I care about. Yes, I care about my work, but yes, I also care about my family, my relationships, and my friends, and my interests, and my creative pursuits outside of my, you know, work. However, all of those things in your life all feed into each other. So it's not good enough to just be, you know, an excellent, for me, like an excellent parent, but just like struggling to pay the bills. It wouldn't be good enough for me to just be like, you know, getting, I don't know, £5 million of investment and feel like I'm smashing it, but actually I never see my kids, or I never have time to kind of, you know, one of my personal interests is cold water swimming. So if I couldn't go for my daily cold water swim with my, you know, with one of my swimming buddies, that means my day hasn't been a success because I've failed to prioritize the things that make me happy and productive and successful. So
I think that you've probably outlined how I feel about my job every day and my family and my kids, and trying to get that balance right between, you know, what's really important to you. And it is really hard to be successful in one area without the others. So that was just such a great explanation of how I'm feeling. So thank you for that. Thank you for sharing that with listeners. I'm sure everyone can relate to what you said. So then if you then take all of that and you think about, well, what then is key to kind of reimagining, you know, our current systems, how are we actually going to change the game in this space? What do you think would be critical to that?
Yeah, again, I'm going to kind of give you two answers, really. I suppose I'm going to give you my sort of professional perspective and my personal perspective. Again, I think to track back to that kind of idea that, you know, reimagining current systems, like, you know, one of my clients once said to me, like, imagine trying to get the US overnight to drive on the left-hand side of the road. Like, overnight. Like, could you imagine the chaos that would ensue if you literally just didn't give them a kind of like lead up period or kind of any sort of in it, just said like, okay, on Tuesday, we're now driving on the other side of the road. You know, that feels like an impossible task that would just lead to absolute chaos. However, someone who was kind of a genius in comms and sort of, you know, infrastructure and planning would probably say like, okay, there is a way. If driving on the other side of the road was critical to, for example, saving the planet, if we had to make some kind of impossible sounding change in order to save the planet, could we do it? Well, yeah, of course we could, because like people think that systems and governments, like I think we often think that they are not, and laws and rules and stuff, like are not made by humans. Like systems don't exist. Humans exist and we enforce the system. So, you know, again, it's on systemic change. Like Rupert Read, who is an amazing professor and one of the leading voices in the climate debate or conversation in the UK, you know, in a recent event that we did, said, and I'll never forget it, he said, like, it's easier, and I think he was quoting another someone else, but nonetheless, this is where I heard it. It's like, it's easier to imagine the end of the planet than it is to imagine the end of capitalism. When you think about that, that's kind of a pretty a pretty kind of profound thing, which I think holds some truth. Like, I think it is easier to imagine the kind of destruction of our planet to a point that we can't change it than it is to imagine a new way of thinking. But that's to suggest that, like, capitalism exists on its own. Capitalism is not it's a concept. It's not a thing. It's not a physical thing that you can touch. It's a way of humans going about their lives. So again, I think that tracks back to how you're in Melbourne, I'm in London. Like, what can you, Eleanor, and me, Chris, do in Melbourne and London to, like, fight against the kind of destructive consumer culture that we live in? Well, what we can do is decide to buy less as individuals. We can decide to buy less. We can decide to think more carefully about what we buy, and rather than maybe buying something on Amazon because it can be delivered by 1 o'clock the next day, why don't we try and find a secondhand shop? Or why don't we try and find or put a WhatsApp group, you know, on our streets and say, like, does anyone have this or does anyone have that? Like, you know, borrow stuff. You know, why do we always need to buy something shiny and new that probably was created in a way that was destructive to the planet? You know, can we reduce our household waste? You know, these sorts of basic things. You know, I've got three kids, there's five of us living in our house, and we really make a concerted effort to have one small bag of non-compostable or recyclable waste per week.
That's very impressive, by the way, you know.
Well, no, but I mean, but you can do it. Like, you can do it. Of course you can. But it's not as if that's not depressing. You know, when you walk around your street and you see someone with, like, six bags of black rubbish, you're like, oh, does that make my one bag just like a kind of drop in the ocean waste of time?
Yeah.
And of course not. But that whole thing of, like, well, what difference does it make if I choose to eat 70% less meat a week? You know, because, you know, look at what X, Y, and Z or countries are doing this, and it can feel a bit depressing. But I think you've got to just try not to get swamped and drowned in all that noise. You just got to try and live your life in a way that you feel is in line with your values, and just try because it's in my head, because I'm a parent, like, raise good kids. Like, when I think about what I'd like my children to kind of go out into the world being, it's not like I don't need them to go and, like, be this sort of hugely successful X, Y, and Z, or speak six languages, or, you know, I want them to go into the world and to be inquisitive. I want them to question everything. I want them to think, like, why do we do that? Or could we do that another way? Or I want them to go out and, like, be, you know, understand that, like, life is a balance, because yes, I do want them to kind of care about nature, but I also understand that they need to, like, pay rent and or buy a house or do all these things. So it's a kind of real balance about how you, I guess, take agency in your life and value the little things that you can do versus, like, kind of trying to chip away at the vast things that just feel overwhelming.
Yep, absolutely. And there was quite a lot in that, and so many ideas, which I love to hear about, and I always love hearing about what people are doing and think about ways that I can improve my own life as well. So is there anything else that you wanted to talk about in terms of what's your own personal commitment to net zero in the next 12 months?
You know, one of my clients, actually, which I really like the idea of, and I might try and implement this, but he set himself the task for a whole year not to buy anything new.
Oh, wow.
And obviously that doesn't cover food, of course. But, like, any sort of tangible objects or things, he did it a couple of years ago, and it was really successful. I think it was such a kind of interesting journey. You know, like, what did he learn about himself, and how did that affect his behavior even now to this day? So I would say, I'm interested in trying to do something like that, because I am aware of, like, the kind of the consumer nature of the world, which just gets more and more and more sort of heavy every year and every day, right? We can just the ease with which we can buy things and have them kind of in our hands, you know, it doesn't sit comfortably with me. So yeah, I like the idea of that. You know, I think just, again, professionally, my goals for this year are to sort of try and keep pushing my clients to be the very best version of themselves they can be, and to sort of, it's very difficult because some of my clients are kind of, you know, multinational corporations, but, like, trying to kind of encourage them to be as sustainable as we can. So even, like, on a very micro level, you know, if we're doing, as I am, a big ballet performance at St. Paul's Cathedral later this year, and we are kind of going to make the cathedral look very beautiful with a lot of flowers, you know, rather than just spend this money and grow these flowers and put the flowers in and then just literally throw them away, like, you know, we're kind of trying to work out ways that we can donate them to a local children's hospital, or, you know, just give everything, try and extend the life of everything as much as we can. And some of those things will have a short life, anyway, some of those things will have a longer life. You know, try and buy a good pair of shoes and make them last 10 years, rather than buy a cheap pair of shoes and buy one every year. Like just a basic kind of, I suppose, ethos, which actually, if I think about my grandparents' generation, like they very much were kind of, would cook a roast chicken on a Sunday and make that chicken last all week. You know, like they'd have soup and they'd have pasties and, you know, just even just with a basic food item, just not just being so disposable, you know, thinking more creatively about that. And, you know, just on a personal level, I think just again, just trying to raise my kids in a way that they kind of are awake and aware that every action has a consequence. That's the key thing, isn't it? You know, there is no such thing as an inconsequential act. You know, might not be obvious, but there's always some kind of, you know, reaction to an action. So yeah, those are my personal goals, you know. And also I think just making them really realize, which is a hard line to hold, because they obviously are getting to a point where they have peer groups and they see what their friends are doing and where their friends go on holiday, for example. And I'm really keen to sort of make my kids understand that you don't need to get on a plane to have an adventurous, inspiring holiday. You know, we can just get on a train and travel to different bits of the UK and see our friends and camp in their gardens. Or, you know, we're lucky we have lots of friends who have, you know, lots of places that we can go make the most of. So, like, you know, I just want them to not think that three skiing holidays a year and, you know, a month in Barbados is the norm, you know, because I don't think that's a sustainable way. Personally, I don't think that's a sustainable way to live.
Yeah, no, there is a lot in that in terms of the way that you think about it and the way you approach your life. And I think one of my favorite things that you said is try to make everything last longer and make it more sustainable, right? It's I'm a big believer in that. And you can always do it if you think about it, in whether that's holiday, whether that's fashion, whether that's food. It is a way, just a way of living that you just make choices around. So on my final question for you is, if you could provide listeners with just one action to take away, what would that be?
Well, having focused a lot of this chat on my personal kind of views, I'm going to finish with something professional, which is that, you know, if you are listening, whether you're a lawyer or whether you're a client relationship manager or whatever you do, if you have some sort of client facing role and you are interested to explore a more creative, engaging, rewarding for everybody way to stay connected to and deepen relationships with your key clients in a way that, this is important, in a way that's truly authentic and meaningful, then you should call me, because I would really love to sort of help you explore ways in which you can, you know, you can do that in a way that is in line with your personal professional values and will hopefully inspire, engage and challenge your clients.
Thanks, Chris. That's a great way to end. And I think definitely some of the things that you've spoken about that you've done will, I'm sure you'll get some calls. I'll be calling you when I'm next in London.
Well, actually, on that point, I mean, just to say, like, it's not, you don't have to do that while I'm in London. I think one of the biggest shifts that I experienced in lockdown and still stays with me and my business today is the live stream element of my work. So, I mean, only last week did I do a live stream street art on skates. I should probably explain what street art on skates is, but a street art tour for a group of clients in Hong Kong, because I created these live stream tours in lockdown when no one could go outside, and I was able to sort of talk about the street art out there on Zoom while people were just in their homes or in their offices. And again, even before Sotheby's, in a former life, I used to be a competitive figure skater. But in lockdown, when I was thinking about ways I could do these live stream tours, I started doing them on foot, and I was a little bit frustrated about how little ground I could cover. And I literally had a light bulb moment, 4 a.m. one morning. Mm. And I woke up and I realized I should do them on my rollerblades. So I set up street art on skates literally the very next day. And within about a week, I was doing live stream tours on my roller skates of Shoreditch in London. And it just really sort of blew up. And you can still actually, I make little short videos, you know, once a week or so, of me skating around talking about interesting pieces of street art, which you can find on my graffiti page, which is House of Graffiti on Instagram. And you can find all those videos there. But even now, I still do live stream tours for clients, as I say, in the US or in Hong Kong or wherever that is. You can live stream to a little slice of London without actually being here. So that's pretty cool too.
That is actually very cool. So thank you. On that note, thanks so much for joining us. It's been a pleasure hearing from you. So thank you again.
You're welcome. Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening. I hope you found this episode both worthwhile and insightful. To learn more about our podcasts, visit ashurst.com/podcasts. This Game Changers and Transition Makers mini-series follows on from our 30 for Net Zero 30 series, and I would encourage you to click on the link in the show notes to find out more, including details of Pentzer events. To ensure you don't miss any future episodes, subscribe now via Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. And while you're there, please feel free to leave a rating or a review. In the meantime, thanks again for listening, and goodbye for now.
If you enjoy ESG Matters at Ashurst, why not check out our other two podcast series as well? Ashurst Business Agenda tackles the big strategic issues that business leaders face. And Ashurst Legal Outlook explains the emerging legal trends and requirements of our fast-changing world. You can listen and subscribe to Business Agenda and Legal Outlook wherever you get your podcasts.